Psalm 59 and 1 Samuel 20, the 15th talk in a series on 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on December 2, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to start out in Psalm 59, and then we'll make our way to 1 Samuel 20. We're going through 1 Samuel. Last week I talked about the incident in which Saul decided to... He definitely decided he wanted to put David to death. He sent out messengers to get him and bring him back and so that Saul could execute him. And Psalm 59 was written on that occasion. It's about that occasion. So I thought that I'd go through it. Just in the last 4 years, I've been doing a little bit of genealogical research. And... have found it very intriguing. But for the most part, what you learn about your ancestors is where they were born, when they were born, and when they died, and where they died. And if you get more information than that, that's wonderful, but that's you're working with bare facts like that. And as I try to piece together my genealogy, the thing that I'm always wondering is, what kind of people were they? I don't come from a family that saves things, so we don't have collections of letters that were passed down and that sort of thing. But in doing the research, that's the kind of thing that would be most interesting to have, is some kind of glimpse into what kind of people they were and what they were thinking about. We are fortunate in this particular instance, in as we're going through 1 Samuel, to have a psalm written that tells us what David was thinking on this occasion when Saul sent his men out to get him. So let's read it. I'll start with the first five verses. We'll go through it in about three or four chunks. Deliver me from my enemies, O my God. Set me securely on high away from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who do iniquity, and save me from men of bloodshed. For behold, they have set an ambush for my life. Fierce men launch an attack against me. Not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Lord, for no guilt of mine they run and set themselves against me. Arouse thyself to help me and see, and thou, O Lord God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to punish all the nations. Do not be gracious to any who are treacherous in iniquity. They return at evening, they howl like a dog and go around the city. Behold, they belch forth with their mouth, swords are in their lips, for they say, who hears? But thou, O Lord, dost laugh at them, thou dost scoff at all the nations. We'll stop there for a second. So David is truly in anguish in this particular situation. In 1 Samuel, I don't think that the account makes it as clear what a momentous event this is and how much fear or anxiety, at least, David is experiencing. And David seems to be genuinely puzzled as to why Saul is so determined to kill him, because David has done nothing wrong. David has not been disloyal to Saul whatsoever. And he's constantly trying to think of what did I do that was wrong, and apparently is confident that he has done nothing that is truly wrong. And it is not just Saul that's after him. In fact, there's no mention of Saul in this psalm at all. It's these men, so it's plural, and he refers to them as fierce men, men of bloodshed, those who do iniquity. Those are the kinds of terms that he's using to refer to the people that are after him. So apparently, within Saul's court, there are some people who have been lobbying that David be taken out. It's probably a relatively small number within the court, but they have been encouraging Saul to take this kind of action against David. And this psalm seems to be primarily aimed at those people who have instigated Saul against him. In this psalm, he is appealing to God to help him in this situation and deliver him. Apparently, God has not been over... This apparently has been happening over some days, that, and maybe weeks, that these people have been instigating against David. And apparently, God has not responded in any overt way to come to David's aid. So David talks in terms of arouse thyself, awake to punish. So David has felt like God is not acting. He's in a desperate situation at the mercy of these treacherous men, and he is appealing to God to now take action. In verses 6 and 7, he kind of describes the behavior of these fierce men. They're like dogs. They're like these dogs that are kind of roaming the street at night looking for something to eat. And they're going all around the city. So one gets the impression that for at least a period of days, there have been these men lurking around David's premises, hoping to find an opportunity to capture him, probably under the cover of darkness, because David is popular. He says in verse 7, they belch forth with their mouth, swords are in their lips, for they say, who hears? Wonderful image. They belch. It's like something that comes up from deep within them. It just kind of comes out. And what do they belch? Well, their swords are in their lips. So they belch murderous desires. And why? Because they say, who hears? They think that they do this in the cover of darkness. They think that all of this is unknown to anyone, and therefore they can feel free to give rein to their murderous desires. But God laughs at them, that all of their scheming and all of their plans are futile. God is well in control of the situation, and everything that they are doing is, in a sense, laughable. In a sense, it's pathetic and sad, but in another sense, it's laughable. There are, let's go on, verse 9. Oh, but before we start this next section, in the NASB, the translation says, because of my strength, because of is in italics, because it's not in the Hebrew text explicitly. Then it says, his strength, but in the margin, it says, many manuscripts and some ancient versions read my strength. The Septuagint has my strength. Several of the Hebrew versions have my strength. And I think that makes more sense. If you look at verse 17, verse 17 is almost a repeat of 9. And it says, O my strength, I will sing praises to thee, etc. So I think this should be, I'm going to amend the text here. So verse 9, my strength, I will watch for thee, for God is my stronghold. My God in his loving kindness will meet me. God will let me look triumphantly upon my foes. Do not slay them, lest my people forget. Scatter them by thy power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. On account of the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be caught in their pride, and on account of curses and lies which they utter, destroy them in wrath, destroy them that they may be no more, that men may know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth. And they return at evening, they howl like a dog and go around the city. They wander about for food and growl if they are not satisfied. So David, where does he look for safety? Where does he turn in this situation of fear, of danger? It's to God, my strength, I will watch for thee, for God is my stronghold. So we see the spirit of David coming out here in the way that we have seen it before in facing Goliath, that his confidence is in God for his protection. And he sees it that way in this situation as well. And he is confident of success. My God in his loving kindness will meet me. God will let me look triumphantly upon my foes. But then he says, don't slay them. Why not slay them? Lest my people forget. He doesn't want his foes to be destroyed. At least initially, we'll see later he does. Don't destroy them immediately. They are a good object lesson in our midst. They are a good thing for us to be aware of and have around. But God will protect. Then he asks in verse 12 that they be caught up in their plotting, that they themselves, that their efforts will be turned back on them, that they'll be caught in their pride and on account of curses and lies which they utter, that all of their attempts will turn back on them and be futile. Then apparently, verse 13, ultimately he wants them destroyed in wrath. And I think what he's asking here is that judgment happen, that those who have been iniquitous men, that such people be destroyed, be eliminated. Why? That men may know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth, as a demonstration of God's power and his justice, that those men who are iniquitous be eliminated. Then verses 14 and 15 refer back to the image that he had already presented in 7 and 8 of these dogs that every evening start prowling around the city looking for food and growl if they are not satisfied. Then he concludes it using words that he has already used, part of it. But as for me, I shall sing of thy strength. Yes, I shall joyfully sing of thy loving kindness in the morning, for thou hast been my stronghold and a refuge in the day of my distress. O my strength, I will sing praises to thee, for God is my stronghold, the God who shows me loving kindness. So again, he takes solace in the fact that God, he's confident that God will take care of him. God will be loyal to him and see him through this. Now, there are a couple of things that I would like to, observations I'd like to make with respect to this psalm. I think it's clearer from this psalm that there is this group of people around Saul that don't like David and would like David to be destroyed, and they have been agitating and encouraging Saul to take this kind of action. It's not just Saul. And in fact, it's probably not primarily Saul in some respects. Saul is an unstable person. And I think there are people within the court who recognize that and want to take advantage of that for their purposes. It's not that Saul is innocent in this matter, I don't think, but there are definitely other people at work here. And it would appear that the attempts to catch David have been going on for more than just one day. This has been something that's happened for at least days, if not longer. And there have been inklings of this, and I suspect that in what we read in last chapter, that Michal, his wife, has picked up on on the seriousness of the situation, maybe even better than David has. David is seeing this as a truly grim situation. He was in great danger of losing his life. This was a serious attempt to try to capture David and kill him. And clearly, David sees God as the one, and ultimately the only one who can save him from his predicament. He is at a huge disadvantage, and without God's help is unlikely to succeed. And so he turns to God for his help. Now, the last thing I want to observe here is a curious little thing. There's a sense in which David universalizes this conflict, that there are three phrases that he uses in this psalm that indicate that he sees a bigger significance to this than just this conflict between David and Saul. The first one is in verse 5, where he's asking God to stir himself up to take action on David's behalf. And it says, "And thou, O Lord God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to punish all the nations." Seems like a strange phrase to throw into this psalm, where the psalm is dealing with David's serious situation at the hands of other Jews, of counselors of Saul. And he says, awake to punish all the nations. So David is seeing this as there's a bigger significance here than just David versus Saul. There's something else going on here. There's another verse where the same kind of move happens, verse 8. "But thou, O Lord, dost laugh at them. Thou dost scoff at all the nations." Once again, why the nations in here? And I think it's for the same reason. David is universalizing this. He's seeing that the opposition to him, David, is parallel to the opposition of the nations outside of Israel to Israel, and ultimately to God. And it's opposition to God, rebelliousness to God, that he's identifying here, I think, ultimately. And then the third hint of this is in verse 13, where he says he wants his opponents to be destroyed. And why? That men may know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth, indicating that God's rule will be extended universally throughout the whole world, that God is the God of the entire world, not just the God of Israel. So there's this tendency, and they're just these things that are included in the psalm that make this a much bigger incident than it would otherwise appear, that David sees significance that goes far beyond just a conflict between David and Saul. And I'll come back to that later. Now let's look at 1 Samuel 20. So last week I talked about Saul trying to get David. And Saul was frustrated in that attempt to get David. David slipped away with the help of Michal, his wife, and coincidentally the daughter of Saul. But David was able to sneak away. He ran to Ramah, where Samuel, the prophet, was. And then Samuel and David went to Naioth, just a little distance away. And that's where they were when Saul learned of where they were, of their location. And Saul sent messengers to get David, to bring him back, to put him to death. And the messengers that went ended up prophesying and were unable to carry out the command that Saul had given them. So after three times, Saul became frustrated with the incompetence of his messengers that he had sent out. So Saul went himself and ended up prophesying himself, and was unable to carry out what he had gone himself to do. So Saul was unable to to arrest David and bring him back to the palace and execute him as he had wanted to do. Chapter 20 then picks up at that point. Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?" And he said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family.' If he says, 'It is good,' your servant shall be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father?" And Jonathan said, "Far be it from you. For if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?" And Jonathan said to David, "Come and let us go out into the field." So both of them went out into the field. So David, apparently, after the events in Naioth, David apparently fled from there, goes back to Gibeah, where Saul is set up capital, and he goes straight to Jonathan, which is a curious thing. David is apparently still not certain that Saul really wants to kill him. As you'll recall, Saul has been has gone back and forth with respect to his feelings towards David and has shown some mental instability on at least two different occasions, has thrown a spear at David to try to kill him. But David doesn't take those as serious and determined attempts on his life. That David still seems to see that as a kind of, those are just episodes that Saul experiences, and it is not a determined and settled desire on Saul's part. So David seems to be still mystified as to what Saul is really up to and whether Saul really wants to kill him or not. So he goes back to Jonathan. So he's taking some risk here. If he could have just fled and gotten out of there completely. But David doesn't want to flee completely unless he absolutely has to. So he goes back to talk to Jonathan to see what's going on, see what Jonathan knows. And he wants to know from Jonathan, what is it that I'm being accused of? What does Saul think that I have done? And David, again, as we saw from the psalm, David is confident of his innocence. He knows of nothing that he has done to undermine Saul's power. Jonathan is incredulous. "Well, Saul's not trying to kill you. My dad's not trying to kill you. If he was trying to kill you, I would know, because I know everything that's going on here, both little matters and great. I know what my father is doing. He tells me everything." And David says, well, I happen to know that he's after me. It must be the case that your father knows that you love me, and so that's why he has not told you. He knows that it would upset you if you knew that that Saul's going to kill me. So that's why he has kept it from you. But David says, I know for a fact he's after me. That's certain. He says, there is hardly a step between me and death. So Jonathan's response is, okay. He says, so what do you want me to do? If that's the case, what do you want me to do? And David has a plan. What David says is, tomorrow is the beginning of the new moon celebration. And apparently this is a two-day celebration that happens on a monthly basis. And apparently this is a time when all of Saul's leading administrators are required to be present. So apparently this is a time when Saul can kind of check in with everybody and they can coordinate what kinds of actions they're taking and just see what one another is doing and how things are going. Just a side comment here. I was reading in another book, which for a whole another purpose, but the author Kenneth Kitchen was talking about Saul's administration, and he estimated that Saul would have had about 500 civil servants working for him, which is interesting. That's a much bigger number than I would have guessed, and I don't know how he estimated this, but Saul has a fairly large administrative apparatus that he has put together. So it makes sense that on a monthly basis he would bring his leading administrators together and have a staff meeting. So David is expected to show up at this. So it's interesting that David's still thinking that he is responsible for showing up at this meal. And if David is thinking that, then David must be thinking that Saul coming after him is not overt to everyone. It's not that everyone knows this. And that Saul must even have some deniability to be able to say, oh, I wasn't coming after you. I didn't want to kill you. There must be some deniability there. Otherwise, why would David even think that he's supposed to come to this thing? It's apparently a two-day event where they eat together on both days. And David's plan is that he will not show up. David's going to stay in hiding and not show up. And Saul will notice his absence. Saul will definitely notice his absence. And David's thinking is, if Saul recognizes that I'm not here, he's going to ask the question, why is David not here? And if he gets mad, then that means that he is really out to get me, because he would be seeing this as an opportunity, a great opportunity for him finally to be able to lay his hands on me. It may not be in the cover of darkness here, but at least he can get his hands on me. So he tells Jonathan, at this festival, if Saul notices my absence and asks where I am, tell him I had to go to Bethlehem for family business to offer sacrifices, and let's see how Saul responds to that. Then David says, David realizes he's really at Jonathan's mercy here. If Jonathan wants to do away with David, he's got a prime opportunity to do so here. Jonathan could easily betray David here, and Jonathan would have good reason to do so. There's a lot at stake for Jonathan. Jonathan will inherit the throne from Saul when Saul dies. But if David comes in and becomes king, then Jonathan will not inherit ever. And in fact, it was common practice in those times, if someone usurps the throne, the first thing you want to do is kill off all of those who have some kind of claim to the throne in order to get rid of the opposition. So if David comes to power, the standard operation would be for David to kill Jonathan. David understands that Jonathan could easily betray him. So David appeals to Jonathan, "Therefore deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father?" David saying, you know, if I am truly guilty of wrongdoing, let's skip a step. Just kill me yourself. David really is sincere in his conviction that he has done nothing wrong. But if he has done anything wrong, then that should be punished. And he's all for it. And Jonathan responds, be assured, I won't betray you. He says, for if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it? Jonathan will get and pass along the information that David so desperately wants to have. So the last glitch then is, this is truly a serious situation. There are people that are all around looking for an opportunity to take me captive. So David has to stay in secret. So the question is, how are you, Jonathan, going to communicate to me what is the nature of Saul's response? And Jonathan has an idea. He says, let's go out into the field and we'll lay this out and we'll talk about it there. We'll talk about it further there. So that's what happens in the next section, starting with verse 12. Then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow, or the third day, behold, if there is good feeling towards David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. And if I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? And you shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies." And Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. When you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day. And you shall remain by the stone Azel, and I will shoot 3 arrows to the side, as though I shot at a target. And behold, I will send the lad, saying, 'Go find the arrows.' But if I specifically say to the lad, 'Behold, the arrows are on this side of you, get them,' then come, for there is safety for you and no harm, as the Lord lives. But if I say to the youth, 'Behold, the arrows are beyond you. Go, for the Lord has sent you away.' As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever." So they go out into the field, and Jonathan gives this plan as to how he's going to communicate to David what he finds out. But before he tells David exactly what the plan is as to how they will communicate, Jonathan wants to reestablish the covenant that he has already made with David and kind of make it a little more explicit and kind of expand it a bit. What he wants is a covenant that is between Jonathan and his family and David and his descendants. He wants this to be a covenant that will be forever. And what he wants is the assurance that David and his descendants will never destroy or cut off Jonathan and his descendants. Verse 14, "And if I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? And you shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So even at that time, when God brings about a universal judgment, where God steps in and destroys all of the enemies of David, even then may my descendants be spared that fate. So Jonathan makes that further covenant, that more specific covenant with David. Then he tells David what the plan is for how he will communicate to David what Saul's response is. And that is, as soon as David is supposed to hide at the place where he was on the eventful day. If you remember about two chapters earlier, there was another incident in which it wasn't clear what Saul was thinking with respect to David. So Jonathan took Saul out into the field to talk over with him what the situation with David, while David was hiding nearby by a rock. Well, apparently that's the same place where David is supposed to hide now. David will hide there. Jonathan will come out to do some target practice. And if he says to the young boy that's with him, apparently he shoots arrows and a young boy goes and gets the arrows back. And in this target practice, if he tells the boy to go further, their way out there, then David knows that he's supposed to flee. But if he tells the young boy, no, they're this way, they're closer in, then that's the signal to David that all's clear. All's fine. He can feel safe and come back. Verse 24. "So David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food, and the king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, it is an accident. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. And it came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Jonathan then answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. For he said, please let me go, since our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away, that I may see my brothers. For this reason he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die. But Jonathan answered Saul his father and said to him, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him." clearly there's some cultural features here that would make this clearer if we knew what they were. David goes out and hides. The first day of the festival starts, and they sit down to eat. The king sits at his regular seat. Abner is sitting next to him. Jonathan is apparently standing ready to serve. And David's seat, apparently on the other side of Saul, is empty. The first day, Saul says, oh, he must be ceremonially unclean. And that can happen. There are any number of ways that can happen. And so he's just assuming that is the problem. But the second day, again, he's not there. David's not there. So this time, Saul says to Jonathan, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal? I think this is this is not the typical form of address, the son of Jesse. He's being a little, I suspect there's a little bit of agitation that is detectable in this form of address. So Jonathan gives the response that they had already rehearsed, that David has gone to Bethlehem to celebrate a family reunion and a sacrifice in there, and so he wanted to go for that reason. Saul gets very upset. And you can just see it. Saul is counting on this opportunity. Saul is to the place where he is desperate to have David dead. And he had been counting on this as an opportunity to get David. If David is not here, that means David may have escaped him for good. So Saul is quite angry. And I suspect that Saul thinks that Jonathan is complicit in this, that Jonathan has helped him. So he uses what I suspect is some kind of swear word, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. So he is angry at Jonathan, and he says, so he swears at him, first of all, and then he kind of suggests to Jonathan something that he thinks could strike home with Jonathan, and that is, don't you realize if David gets away and lives, there is the chance that you will never be king. He says in verse 31, for as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. So he's appealing to Jonathan's desire for power. He's trying to tap into that and get Jonathan to be cooperative with him, Saul, in his effort to kill David. So he says to Jonathan, send for him and bring him back here. For he must surely die. So now it's clear to Jonathan that David was right. Saul is out to kill him, very definitely. So Jonathan asks, well, what has David done? And Saul does not respond. Saul doesn't answer. He just picks up that spear and he chucks it at Jonathan. Apparently misses him, but somebody should take that spear out of that room. So then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. This is very upsetting to Jonathan. And what's interesting is that the focus of what's upsetting to him is not the spear just missing him, but rather that David has been dishonored. And so Jonathan can't eat. Next section. Now it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field for the appointment with David, and a little lad was with him. And he said to his lad, run, find now the arrows which I am about to shoot. As the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? And Jonathan called after the lad, hurry, be quick, do not stay. And Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master. But the lad was not aware of anything. Only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, "Go, bring them to the city." When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed each other and wept together, but David more. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" Then he rose and departed, while Jonathan went to the city. So, just as Jonathan had promised he would do, he goes out into the field to do some target practice. He has the young boy there. He tells the boy, "Start running." This is a strange target practice. He says, "Start running," and then he shoots over the young boy's head. It's a brave young boy. And he says, "Go further." So that's the sign that had been agreed upon. That's what indicates to David that he is in serious trouble. He needs to flee. After the target practice, after the signal has been given, Jonathan gives his weapons to the young boy and asks him to leave. Apparently, at this point in time, Jonathan and David feel confident that there are no spies nearby. All this signal had to be worked out because apparently there some of Saul's men were still lurking about. At least there was the fear that Saul's men were lurking about, looking for an opportunity to capture David. Well, apparently they are confident that that is not the case. David comes out of hiding, and they exchange their farewells. And David falls down on his face to the ground and bows three times before Jonathan. David is genuinely thankful for Jonathan's loyalty to him. Jonathan could have turned on him easily, and it would have been, in many respects, in Jonathan's benefit to do that, but Jonathan did not betray the confidence. They weep together, and it says, David more, that David is genuinely touched by Jonathan's loyalty and Jonathan's spirit. And in Jonathan's last words, he says, "Go in safety," and then reminds him of the covenant that's been made between David and his descendants and Jonathan and his descendants forever. And then David takes off running, and Jonathan goes back to the city. There are a couple of things in here that I'd like to talk about in specific. The first is, Jonathan is a very impressive man in this account, it seems to me. Jonathan has a lot to lose by David taking Saul's place. Jonathan is the heir to the throne, and as I mentioned before, if David were to become king, in all likelihood, Jonathan would be put to death. Furthermore, it doesn't look like David's going to win in this situation. If you were to ask in Las Vegas what the odds on David are, they would be bad. Saul's got all the cards at this point in time. Saul's still the king. Saul has an army at his disposal. David has no one really to defend him. So it looks like David is a bad bet if Jonathan is interested in playing the odds here. Furthermore, Jonathan could assure David's defeat. It'd be really easy for Jonathan to arrange that David be killed. All he would have to do is betray him. Jonathan recognizes that David is something special. He recognized that when David went out against Goliath. And there are two things, I think, in particular that Jonathan noticed. One was that God's hand seemed to be on David and made it possible for David to be victorious in that conflict with Goliath. So Jonathan sees God working on David's behalf. And the other thing, I think, is he senses a kinship with David. David has the same heart that Jonathan has. And Jonathan identifies with that very strongly and wants to, clearly wants to have a relationship with David because there's something special about David in that heart. So Jonathan recognizes that in this conflict between David and Saul, this is not just a typical conflict that happens in a court in any kingdom between a king and some high-ranking official. There is something much more significant in this. And it is interesting, I don't know exactly what Jonathan was thinking when he wanted to enter into a covenant with David that lasts forever. He may have just been thinking for a long time, but the term that he uses is forever. So there's this sense in which Jonathan is seeing in this and what's going on here significance that goes way beyond the time in which they are located. And that brings me to the second observation that I want to make, and that is both David and Jonathan, throughout these chapters, are seeing something that is much bigger than the people around them are identifying as being the case. We've already talked about this with respect to David's killing of Goliath, that David saw in Goliath something more than just a big Philistine. What he saw in Goliath was someone who embodied hostility towards the God of Israel. And for that reason, David had confidence going against him because David sensed that this was a situation in which God was going to make his power known and was going to make sure that Goliath was taken down. So there is the first instance, I think, we see of David recognizing that something bigger is going on here. In Psalm 59 that we just read, there are those indications that David is seeing something bigger there than just a conflict between David and Saul, that it has much bigger implications. It's really a part of a much bigger conflict, and that is a conflict between those who love God and those who are hostile to God. And Jonathan seems to sense that David is going to become king of Israel. We haven't seen any indication, really, for sure in the narrative, that even David knows he'll become king of Israel. We know that Samuel knows that David will become king of Israel. We know that Samuel anointed David. We know that David knows he's anointed. But we don't yet know that David knows that he will become the king of Israel. We don't know that Jonathan knows that either. But Jonathan seems to think that that is the case. Jonathan seems to think that David's kingship will eventually become worldwide. And it will be long-lasting, maybe even forever. It is an interesting question, I think, to ask whether Saul recognizes that there is something bigger happening here, that this is much more than just a conflict between him and David, that there are spiritual significance to this. And I don't know the answer to that. How do David and Jonathan know that there is something more significant that's happening here? And I don't know the answer to that. Somehow they're sensing that. They have seen some rather remarkable events. David has been anointed. That is something of significance. I don't think he knows the significance of it, but he knows that that has happened. As David gave his background to Saul, why he was a good person to send out to Goliath, to fight against Goliath. He mentioned that he had fought against lions and bears and that God had preserved him in that. So he's had events like that in his life. He has gone out against Goliath and he has been victorious. So that's another very remarkable event in David's life. He has had success against the Philistines that goes beyond the successes that Israelites had had previous to him. And in particular, he had gone out and collected the 200 foreskins from the Philistines that Saul had asked as a dowry for taking his daughter in marriage. And he's received God's protection from Saul. So David has witnessed a number of remarkable events in his life that are significant and may be things that are all in the back of David's mind as he tries to put together what's going on. Jonathan has seen many of those same things himself, but he seems to be, as it seems to me, a little bit further along in piecing together and extrapolating from what is happening. And he seems to see, in particular, the kind of heart that David has and recognizes that there is something special about that kind of heart and God is doing something unique in his life. So they're both reading events and extrapolating from them. I don't know how much they knew about the teachings and the Pentateuch. They probably were familiar with them. They probably have read them, but I don't know that for sure. They have seen God act in their experience relatively overtly, and yet they can only dimly make out what God seems to be doing. They recognize a few things, recognize them rightly, and they're extrapolating rightly, but only in very general, vague terms. I think that's interesting with respect to us in our time and whether that is possible for us. And I think the answer is, yes, it's possible for us, but we live in murkier times. We don't have the same kinds of actions that correlate with God's specific promises to be able to extrapolate the way that they did, I think. God works less overtly, as I've argued before, is working less overtly in our time. And furthermore, we are not in the center of history. David, from God's perspective, was pretty much the center of the plot line of history. We're on the fringes of it. But I think that the principle that's at work in David and Jonathan is the same. That if we love God, we are attracted to the things of God. And we will see and be attracted to those things of God that we see in others. We will be attracted to those who exhibit God's character. And we will be inclined to recognize God's activity as we see it happening. But I think that's true only in very broad strokes. I have to go a couple more minutes. As I was thinking about this, I recalled a passage from Jacques Ellul's book, The Meaning of the City. And in The Meaning of the City, and I will make this very brief, in The Meaning of the City, what Jacques Ellul is talking about is the significance of the city in the Bible. He says that the city becomes a symbol of something. And what does it become a symbol of? It becomes a symbol of man in his rebelliousness against God, mankind coming together and cooperating to create their own world, their own environment, their own system, their own life in independence from God. And so the city becomes a symbol of man's rebelliousness in a concentrated form. And what he argues is that God built that into history. That's something that God designed, that man would work out his rebelliousness towards God in a large scale so that everyone can see it. But it is wicked to the core. The city, that is, man's concentrated efforts to be independent from God. And that a system would be developed that would be at its root ungodly and contrary to everything that God stands for and that everyone who loves God stands for. So what Elul argues is that's a terrible environment to be in if you love God. And that, but he argues we ought not flee from that. It is good and proper for us to live in the midst of that up to a certain point. And Elul suggests that there will come the time when those who love God will be called out of the city. And then he describes that when that happens, and this is the paragraph that I'm interested in. He says, their task is neither to try to discover his means nor to speculate vainly. God will tell them how to act when he tells them to act. And when the time has come, God's people will know with a sure knowledge, with a certitude not discernible from the outside, not measurable intellectually, but absolutely undeniable, that the time has come to leave Babylon. I think it's very curious what he's suggesting there. What he's suggesting is there's no way to predict how people will know that it is time to leave Babylon. But God will make that known to them. And it's not going to be the kind of thing that someone on the outside is going to be able to analyze, but it's going to be something that God will make clear. We don't have to worry about how it'll happen. God can do that, and God will do that. Okay, I have gone over time. I guess I'll have more time for questions next time. Thanks.